I'm Jerry Barmash, and this is Here Now the News. After 8 months, the coronavirus is worse now in the United States than it has ever been. The number of cases is increasing across the country, with 150,000 in one day, the highest level of the pandemic. Deaths keep mounting as well. A startling new model by the nationally renowned IMHE predicts more than 438,000 COVID-19 deaths by March. Utah's one state trying to stay ahead of the spread. In this episode, I'll talk to a hospital executive from Salt Lake City, Dr. Russell Vinnick. We'll discuss an influx of patients as Utah decides to mandate mask wearing, at least on a temporary basis, to control COVID. President-elect Joe Biden has said he'll call for mandatory mask usage on day one in office. In our conversation, the doctor talks about the biggest need for his hospital as cases rise and his concern as the holidays approach. Joining me right now is Dr. Russell Vinnick. He is the Chief Medical Operations Officer at University of Utah Health. Thanks for joining me today on Here Now the News, Doctor.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we've been seeing throughout the country a surge, a second wave, if you want to call it, of COVID. And Utah is among those, one of the states that is seeing record numbers right now. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, certainly. We didn't have a big surge in March and April. We were preparing for a big surge, and fortunately that never hit us. And then we had one in July, and it calmed down towards August. And then pretty consistently, since the end of August, we've had a very steady increase in cases, but the pace is picking up, particularly over the last couple of weeks, since about Halloween. About 2.5 weeks ago, we were about 1,500 cases per day in Utah. Yesterday, we hit almost 4,000. So it's been pretty dramatic. And of course, those have translated into hospitalizations. We had a low of a little bit under 20 patients towards the end of August in our hospital, which was, things were looking really good. And that number has steadily climbed over the past 8 weeks to today. We have almost 70 patients in our hospital, and about a third of them being in the ICU, two-thirds being outside of the ICU. And so we're at capacity. We're running about 95% capacity, both in the ICU and non-ICU.
You mentioned the number almost 4,000. That was a daily high. Are the numbers you're seeing in hospitalizations, is that a record as well?
Absolutely. The state is reaching records every day of new hospitalizations statewide, around 90 new hospitalizations a day, what it's been lately. And same thing in our hospital. We admitted, I think, 18 patients in a 24-hour period compared to where we were in August, where we had 18 patients in our hospital at one time. And now we're admitting that number in a single day, with an average length of stay of about 7 days.
You mentioned capacity. I have to ask you about that. And we were here in New York. We went through this, as I'm sure you know, at the beginning, at the end of March and through April. We were at capacity. Hospitals, ICUs, they were adding space wherever they could, adding beds. What is it like for you there?
Yeah. We fortunately had a lot more preparatory time than you did in New York. And so we've been able to plan for this since March and April. And so we set aside one unit and converted that to an ICU and got all the equipment necessary so that could be an ICU. And so that gave us an additional 23 beds for surge ICU patients. Now the difficulty is there's two parts of the equation. One is beds and equipment, and the other is staff. And turns out it's a lot easier to buy equipment than it is to hire trained doctors and nurses, which is almost impossible right now because this is a national epidemic and a worldwide epidemic. So we're having to staff those beds with surge staffing. And what that means is a combination of doctors, nurses picking up shifts. Some of my great ambulatory colleagues are saying, you know what, I work in the clinic, but I'll come help you guys and work on the inpatient side for a week. We're working, trying to redeploy some of our ambulatory nurses and kind of everybody taking a bit of a stretch. And that's what we call contingency care. It's not what you normally do. You normally don't have outpatient docs practicing inpatient. You normally don't have outpatient nurses inpatient. You normally don't have floor nurses in the ICU. But those are the things we have to do to be able to take care of these patients.
And what you're giving a sense right now, but can you give a little bit more of a picture of what the ER is like?
So the ER, so interestingly, our emergency room volume compared to pre-COVID levels has been a little bit lower than it was in the past. The number of patients is lower, although the patients that are getting hospitalized is higher. So a lot of people are not coming to the ER for the more minor things, which might be a good thing. We certainly don't want patients to skip out on the ER when they've got something life-threatening. So our emergency room has been able to keep up in part because we just have seen consistently lower volume for other types of illnesses since COVID.
So what does that mean? If you're seeing a rise with COVID and with bed capacity, are they skipping the ER?
So certainly the people that are very ill are still coming to the ER, and those are the people that get admitted to the hospital. And we've seen that those numbers are significantly higher than pre-COVID. So the less ill people are either staying home or using virtual visits. It's hard for us to know what happens to the less ill people because we don't have a good grasp. If they don't come, we don't know that they had symptoms. There was clearly data back in March and April of people with chest pains and heart attacks dying at home because they were afraid to come to the ER. And that's something we certainly are very concerned about. We want people who have critical illness to come to the ER. We've got room to take care of them. And they need to, if you need to be in the emergency room, you should be in the emergency room. The hospital is a safe place for people. The transmission of COVID in the hospital is extremely minimal. We've seen a few handful of cases of healthcare worker to healthcare worker transmission or patient to healthcare worker transmission. But for the most part, it is a very safe place. Our rates of COVID in our employees are significantly lower than that in the general population. So that says a lot.
And do you think that's, again, as you were saying before, that you had time to prepare to get ready? Is that also in terms of getting gowns and equipment and masks and just seeing how all the other cities have handled it?
Yeah, we've been fortunate that way, that we've had 8 months now to get all the equipment we needed. And certainly in March and April, you couldn't buy it. We had volunteers that sewed over 1 million masks, the reusable masks with hospital grade fabric. So we have all the equipment. And so there's no shortage. Nobody's complaining or concerned that they don't have the equipment they need to safely take care of patients. And so that is a big difference. We've got the gowns. We've had volunteers sew gowns, so we have ample stores of that, N95 masks. We've had our own Center for Medical Innovation on our campus building PAPRs, and I think we've built several hundred of those. So we've got all that equipment, but I think it's also important, I mean, not just that our hospital employees have similar rates to the population, but lower rates. So what that means, I think, is our employees are taking this very seriously. They see the harm that happens from COVID. And so when they're out in the community, I believe that they are taking more precautions than what we see elsewhere. Most transmission, even when our employees do get COVID, the vast majority of them get it from a contact in the household and in the community, not in the hospital. So really taking those precautions when they're at home and with the public is keeping them safe.
Just one other question on that same, from March to where we are now, and you're seeing this surge now. Have you learned anything as we've seen over these months as it has spread and you know, ebbed and flowed? Has it evolved?
Yeah, we've learned a lot. Obviously, there have been treatments that have changed and evolved over time. Certainly very early on in the pandemic, the dogma was early intubation. Intubate people early, control the airway, control the air, so that you're not having to emergently intubate people. And what we found with COVID was you're better off to delay intubation as long as you can, use high flow nasal cannula or even non-invasive ventilation like IPAP, and that improves outcomes. We've learned about the high risk of thrombosis and blood clots in this population. We've got some treatments. We have remdesivir, we have steroids and dexamethasone. When I look at some national data, I don't see a big change in COVID-related mortality over the last 3 or 4 months. There was a big change from March through about May or June, and then it seemed to level off. But mortality has dropped significantly since those early months. And I believe that's because hospitals have prepared. They just haven't had that degree of stress that was happening in March and April, and a stress system just doesn't perform well. If you don't have nurses to turn patients and prone patients, you know, proning is something that's very time intensive to do. I've met with one of my intensivists, it takes 6 people to prone a patient. So proning, turning that patient on their stomach, you can imagine with all of the lines and a ventilator and an endotracheal tube to do it properly and carefully without dislodging that tube, it is a process.
More coming up with Dr. Vinnick, including the move to mandatory face covering in his state.
The governor, the Utah governor, just enacted a 2-week emergency order that includes mandating masks. Is that enough at this point?
Personally, from a physician standpoint, I have the benefit of only thinking about lives and what's best for the public health. And the governor and the politicians have a balance, which makes it harder. From my perspective, I would love to see more happening. We know in medicine, when you've got a crisis, if you've got somebody who's septic, you don't try a surgical approach to treat that infection. You give them broad spectrum antibiotics because you know if you're unsuccessful, that patient might die and you don't want to do a trial and error. And so I think of this pandemic as similar, is that we are in such a crisis right now, we don't have the opportunity to be wrong. So I personally would have liked to have seen something broader that included bars, gyms, and other establishments. But certainly that didn't happen, and I'm very concerned. But we're going to be here, and we're going to do the best we can with the policies that are in place.
And it's 2 weeks. It goes until, I believe, days or the week before Thanksgiving. Do you anticipate that will be extended? And as you said, do you think that it will be expanded?
Yeah, I really don't know. It's a very interesting political climate in Utah with the election that just happened. The governor-elect was the former head of the COVID task force. And so it's a little bit hard to know politically what the next step is likely to be.
With that in mind, is there concern? We've heard this throughout the country, that the winter, even Dr. Fauci has said this, the winter will be much worse for COVID, not the least of which with the flu, and then that can mask it and cause, I guess, more problems. Are you worried as we are now on the threshold of wintertime?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think part of the significant worsening we've seen in Utah has been it's gotten very cold here. It's been snowing off and on for a week now. And so pretty much everything that used to happen outdoors is happening indoors now. So the good news is I think we've reached pretty much the peak as far as winter weather. It'll get colder, but the weather is not conducive to anything happening outdoors. So yes, but I am utmost concerned about Thanksgiving, and we've got big families in Utah, and a tradition of Utah families getting together, and families getting together around a table over a meal is a recipe for disaster. And as much as we can, we've tried to talk. Number one, you know, the governor has recommended people not get together, and we fully support that. But if people do get together, just some very simple things to think about is, number one, and probably most important, is if you go into someone else's home or any building that's not your own house, wear a mask. Number two, if people come into your home that don't live with you, you should wear a mask and they should wear a mask. There seems to be this kind of exemption for family members, and your family is just as likely as you and anybody else to get infected. And it's not, it's not anything bad to ask your family member to wear a mask. I certainly did that. I saw my family a few weeks ago, and we all wore masks, and it was different. I hadn't seen my brothers in 9 months, but we all saw each other and we wore masks and we kept our distance. The third thing, you know, if you're going to be outdoors but within 6 feet of someone else, wear a mask. So if we can't avoid those social gatherings, at least to do some basic things to make them a lot safer. And masks are so effective.
No, I was just going to ask you, aside from what you're seeing in the hospital, are people in Utah, are they complying with the mask rules?
So in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County, my experience is I see very good compliance. I haven't gotten out much lately, but my friends and colleagues who go to other parts of Utah see a very different picture with very little compliance. This was several months ago, I went to a fast food establishment, and the people who were preparing the food were not wearing masks. And it was just amazing to me, fighting this war that we're fighting here, to see food preparers not wearing masks is really bothersome.
We know that there's a lot of progress we're hearing about vaccines, but is that at this point something that could make a difference, and how soon on the front lines there in the hospital?
Yeah, well, what we are hearing is the very earliest we will see any vaccine distributed is likely to be mid-December-ish. And the first people that are likely to get vaccinated, I believe every state has different protocols, but healthcare workers are typically at the very front of those vaccine protocols. And that makes sense. And these are protocols that are typically developed with state health departments and the public's input. But it makes sense. You obviously need to have healthy healthcare workers first and foremost. And then typically vulnerable populations. Institutionalized, especially those that are in care facilities, prisons. And so even though it's going to take 6 to 12 months before the majority of the U.S. population is vaccinated, if we can start to vaccinate those high-risk people who are most likely to be hospitalized, you know, even if we could take 10 or 20% off of that list of people who are likely to be vulnerable, we'll see a big improvement in our hospitalization numbers. But we're talking January, you know, probably February, March at the earliest before we see much of an impact from vaccines.
Right. And again, that's why they're still saying social distance is the answer, and obviously wearing a mask. One other question, I want to go back to capacity again in the hospital as this surge continues. Are you getting or do you need help from Washington to help funds for equipment?
At places that we need help, we've got adequate equipment in our hospital. We don't have adequate nurses, and that is something that I don't think Washington can necessarily provide. We've had some calls with federal agencies, and they're strapped as well. Obviously, every state in the country needs personnel. Testing is huge. These rapid antigen tests to be able to much more broadly test asymptomatic people would be a significant improvement. And we have received some in Utah just recently of the BinaxNows to be able to test college students but more testing supplies, particularly these rapid antigens, would be a huge help. And the federal government's been helpful with that. But certainly if we were to expand this and be able to test regularly, we're going to need a lot more supplies from the federal government.
And just to ask again about the mask, is it unfortunate that it has turned into a politicized, a political symbol, the mask?
It's a terrible thing that masks have been politicized. I do kind of remember 20 years ago how seatbelts were political for a little while, and people got over that. The truth is masks can save a lot more lives than seatbelts. There's nothing political about it. It's protecting yourself and protecting the people around you. There is absolutely no risk of wearing a mask. And it's sad to see some of these data contorted from, oh, there's a risk of lower oxygen levels. There's a risk that, you know, I've seen people complain that child abductors wear masks, so therefore we shouldn't wear masks. I don't know. That certainly seems like a stretch. Masks are life-saving. Wear them.
I just heard today, and not to put you on the spot, there was a congresswoman-elect from Georgia who has said she won't wear it. And it's right now you have to wear it on the floor of the Capitol, where everyone obviously is gathering. And she is saying she won't, and she won't be oppressed, and that it's violating her freedom. What do you make of that? I mean, you're right there. You see what's happening.
You know, I mean, we control what we control, and Congress controls what happens on their floor. I can tell you, we do not allow people in our hospital unless they are masked. And that's the, I should hope that every business and every establishment thinks highly enough of their patrons to do the same, is that you want to protect the patrons from each other and from your staff, and protect your staff. And we could come a long way by just having that mentality.
I want to thank you for a few minutes of your time.
My pleasure.
It's Dr. Russell Vinick from the University of Utah. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Take care. Nice meeting you.
Help is on the way. More than 30 nurses from New York Presbyterian Hospital are joining the battle in Utah. It's reminiscent of when healthcare workers in the spring arrived in New York from across the country. Utah isn't the only location putting new restrictions in place. San Francisco shut all indoor dining. Denver is under an overnight curfew with limited exceptions. While Massachusetts and New York are among the states putting the brakes on indoor dining at 10 p.m. Next week, I'll delve into that portion of the COVID crisis. I'll explore the economic impact it's taking on one bar in New York City and how an iconic bookstore is struggling for its survival, along with many other small businesses. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe, and if you can share episodes, that would be great too. You can contact me with any feedback, including interview suggestions, on Twitter at Jerry Barmash, or email hearnowthenewsjb@gmail.com. Join our Facebook page, Hear Now the News. If you like what you hear, please give a 5-star rating and review if you use Apple as your podcast platform of choice. I'm Jerry Barmash. This is Hear Now the News.